And we'll move to the third case this morning, Everhart v. Cook County Sheriff's Department.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Chris Langone, and I represent the plaintiff appellant in this matter, Yvonne Everhart. In my time today, I'd like to try to focus on two primary issues. One is the Merit Board decision and this relationship that the Merit Board decision had with the district court's opinion, the essential what we call de facto res judicata deference that the district court gave the Merit Board decision, and then the district court's misapplication of the appropriate legal standards, specifically in not allowing or evaluating our case under the direct method using circumstantial evidence and confusing and applying the test that was disavowed by this court in Spiglia, namely the but-for causation test as opposed to the motivating factor test in a retaliation case.
Now, of course, she claims that she discredited all of the allegations against her at the Merit Board hearing. What evidence is there that she didn't have unauthorized contact with inmates?
The evidence was that she wasn't even assigned in the division at the time. For instance, at the time that she's having unauthorized contact with inmates allegedly in Division 9, she's in Division 5. She had called coworkers that would walk the tiers with her.
She'd had over 200 phone calls from inmates to her.
To her son. Her son testified before the Merit Board that he had basically run on behalf of his friends, kind of an operator's switchboard for inmates out of the Cook County Jail because it was an authorized number that, you know, could receive calls from the jail. So that was done without her knowledge. The testimony was that it was done without her knowledge before the Merit Board. Of course, the district court never had the opportunity to review that testimony because when we sought to attempt to bring the administrative review action into the district court to amend our complaint, we were denied the right to do that. And mind you, we only attempted to do that after we first tried to have the district court action stayed under Colorado River to assert those claims in the circuit court.
What agency was this evidence regarding the telephone switching?
This was before the Sheriff's Merit Board, which is an agency that's set up basically to give government employees their due process rights before they're terminated. What had happened here was Everhart was recommended to be terminated and suspended without pay and then sent off to the Merit Board.
As I read your opponent's brief, they've abandoned all of the arguments that they were making about the Merit Board, given what happened and the fact that the Merit Board action was changed by the circuit court. And the thrust of their argument is we can support the judgment below on any other ground that's in the record, and here are all these other grounds that support the judgment below. And so, first of all, that's what I understand the posture of this case to be right now. I have a not-so-picky procedural question for you, though. I can't find any response from Ms. Everhart to the defendant's motion for summary judgment in the record on appeal. And I looked at the docket sheet that is appended to your brief, and it looks to me, if I'm not mistaken, that docket entry number 55 in the district court, and you seem to have indicated this is a Roman numeral 9 page somehow, if I'm reading this correctly. Anyway, that looks like the document in the district court, but it's very hard to evaluate whether summary judgment is properly granted or not if you don't have both Rule 56 statements.
Okay, my understanding is those documents were filed with the magistrate judge.
They are not part of the record on appeal, and it is the responsibility of the appellant under Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 10 and this circuit's rules to make sure that the materials are in this court that we need for review.
Okay, it was my understanding that those were, I mean, I would
I mean, it may have been before. I mean, it certainly looks like it was before the district court. I don't question that for a minute, but it's not in the record on appeal.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would make a motion to supplement the record.
You have to do that in the district court first. I mean, it's really a little late in the day. I mean, it seems...
Okay, that's something that... It was not something that I was aware of. I mean, the defendant was trying to argue that, you know, in the side of this case, that we're talking about citing record, you know, evidence beyond the record that was ever in the district court, which we dealt with in our briefs.
Right. No, that's a whole different matter. But it looks to me like, if I'm reading this correctly, item 55 is a motion by the plaintiff for leave to file what's called a response brief, nunc pro tunc. That's June 23rd, 2004. And then item 56, Judge Keyes grants the motion to leave to file the response brief. And then you find motion 57, or item 57, where the Cook County parties want to strike what's described as plaintiff's response brief and statement of additional facts, parenthesis, attachment. So I infer from that that the thing that was filed, nunc pro tunc, had your statement of facts. But again, I mean, I just don't know how we can manage this without these materials in front of us.
Well, I mean, first of all, at one level, to the extent that the district court made just completely applied the incorrect standards, that would be a basis for a remand. I mean, I don't think it is this court's job when it's clear from the record that the district court applied a completely erroneous legal test, namely the but-for test instead of the motivating factor test. I don't think it would be this court's job to go and have to scour through the record anyway to then apply the correct test and come to the correct result, even in a de novo review. I think the appropriate thing to do would be to reverse the district court, advise the district court that it had applied the incorrect test, and then remand to the district court to apply the correct test.
But I will say the problem is we don't even know if that error was ultimately harmful or not unless we know what
you are.
The summary judgment record is. We have before us the facts as the Cook County parties say they were, and if you suspend disbelief for a moment and you accept all of those facts and assume there's nothing on the other side, it really doesn't make any difference if it's a motivating factor test or a but-for test or anything else. They say, you know, under any circumstances in the world, Ms. Averhart had violated these various rules and it had, you know, all of these things happen that they rehearse in their brief, the unauthorized contact, the theft, the, you know, this and the that. So I'm just very troubled that the record hasn't come up properly for us to know what to do with it, even if you're right and the district judge under these circumstances should have taken an approach along the Spiegel lines. How do you know if it mattered?
Again, first of all, what is clear before this court was that, and from the district court's opinion, was that the district court was relying on the merit board's credibility determinations and findings. And it basically used that rationale to defeat our McDonnell-Douglas case on the grounds that, well, there was a legitimate non-discriminatory reason, the merit board, you know, there was no evidence the merit board was biased, and to the extent that the merit board had a hearing and determined that the determination was justified, and in the absence of any evidence, and I will concede there was no evidence that, you know, we did not seek to challenge the merit board's bias because that was not an issue before the court. I mean, that would be an impossible standard for any government employee to make because basically you would have to show that the body that was set up by the state essentially to provide due process and to make sure that government employees got a hearing before they were deprived of their job interest was biased.
I understand that, but the truth is I can't even tell what the district court relied on because looking at the district court's opinion, he refers to plaintiff's additional facts, paragraph this and that. He refers to the fact that the defendants moved to strike, and he doesn't tell us which facts he was accepting, which he was not. All he says is, the court will disregard this and all additional facts not properly supported by citations to the record. I don't know whether that was 1 or 50 or I don't know what he's looking at.
Okay, well, that is obviously of concern, and I'm going to, as soon as I get back to my office, try to look into, you know, what motions can be made to correct that or what the effect of that might be as regards this appeal, and I guess if appropriate, I might seek leave to file a brief on that point. Nevertheless, in terms of the issues we have raised, we do have these issues concerning the merit board. And I do want, in the interest of disclosure to the court, to advise the court that after Judge Donnersberger remanded, the merit board has now reissued a new decision saying that Everhart is terminated. And the time to file an administrative review action from that decision has not expired. It expires next week sometime, and we will be taking that administrative review, and then we will be back in the same situation, which is, although it's a different merit board decision amongst a different record, what deference goes. And, you know, we were particularly concerned because of this court's opinion in Durgins, which says that if, you know, you take an administrative review from a merit board, you don't have to take one. And if you don't take one, you're fine on res judicata. But if you do take one, and then the circuit court affirms it, you're barred under state law doctrine of merger and bar. So we want to make sure that, you know, that's why we want everything. We were prepared to move everything because there was no circuit court administrative review action when we filed our action in the district court. As soon as there became one, we wanted to move it there, and we still do. To the extent there's a reversal, we will be asking to assert our claims in the circuit court with Judge Donnersberger so we do not run into that Durgins problem. I will save the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Maureen Ferrick. I represent the Sheriff of Cook County and Cook County in this matter, the defendant appellee. I can't respond to plaintiff's brief in the fashion that they have presented it to the court because it is our position that they are fundamentally incorrect in their approach. This court has de novo review of the district court's record. We pointed that out in our brief that we filed with the court.
And but, you know, sometimes in order to exercise that de novo review responsibility, we look at a district court opinion and we say it's, in a sense, procedurally inadequate for us to perform that function. We can't tell what facts the district court was relying on, which facts the court thought were undisputed, which facts the court thought were admissible or not. We can't evaluate challenges. We don't get enough of an explanation. So sometimes we just have to send it back to the district court and say, do your job. In this case, I mean, I'm very disturbed by the point in the district court opinion that I just mentioned, since I really have no idea what Judge Keyes was looking at.
And you don't have any idea what Judge Keyes is looking at because plaintiff failed to file an appropriate record.
No, I wouldn't know even if plaintiff had filed document 55. Judge Keyes says about a document that had many paragraphs in it, you can tell that by reading the opinion, I'm going to accept some and I'm not going to accept others. He doesn't tell us which ones he's accepting. He doesn't tell us why he isn't accepting certain parts of it. He doesn't tell us because it's, you know, for example, hearsay or because there's no personal knowledge or whatever. They're all the usual reasons why you might not. But even if that document had been before us, which we'll assume it's the plaintiff's fault, it's not before us, it still wouldn't have mattered if we can't tell what the magistrate judge was doing.
But I think that you would be able to tell, and you'd be able to
How?
Tell quite.
Am I a mind reader?
Because you would look at the document. We filed objections to plaintiff's statements of additional fact, and we spelled out in great detail why many of those assertions were just on their face unacceptable. For example,
but he doesn't say, if he had said, I accept every objection that Cook County raised, then I would agree with you. And then I would say, fine, all I need to do is look at the Cook County filings, see what they objected to, correlate it back to this. But unfortunately, he doesn't say that. He just says the court will disregard this and all additional facts not properly supported.
There were 307 paragraphs
exactly.
put forth.
Exactly. That's a lot
of
paragraphs.
And the problem, I think, was that there were only six, and I concede that plaintiff's testimony can be admissible evidence to create a genuine issue of material fact. It was not defendant's position that because plaintiff testified to it, it should be stricken. Looking at it in the light most favorable to plaintiff, there were only six paragraphs that we felt could contain admissible evidence.
I understand that was your position, but surely you don't imagine that every time Cook County says something in court, the judge rubber stamps it as correct. I mean, maybe there were seven. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's a small number.
And I think in the context of 307 assertions, what the circuit court did was, in the body of the brief, discuss specific. You'll note the court drops many footnotes throughout
but
its order.
But what if he was wrong about one of them? Sometimes district judges say, I reject paragraph 103, and we look at paragraph 103 and we think, actually, that one was all right. It could have come in.
But I think what he did in the face of 307 inappropriate assertions of fact.
You are saying it's inappropriate, but how do I know that?
Because he takes those from the 307 that he thinks have relevance to the issues before the court on the question of whether there is Title VII retaliation, whether there is a Section 1983 deprivation, and he discusses those. And he presents his reasoning.
And we're supposed to just infer from his cryptic little comment that those are the only ones that he wanted in?
I think he pulls out the ones that are relevant. He discusses in footnotes why he felt that those particular assertions were not accompanied by fact pursuant to Rule 56 or Rule 56.1 to allow the court to deny our motion for summary judgment.
Why are you opposing Averhart's attempt to have her claims consolidated in either state or federal court?
Well, the problem in the state court system is that she failed to comply with the administrative requirements. She didn't go to the Illinois Human Rights Commission, which she's mandated to do by statute. She put herself in this box by failing to follow the procedures necessary in the Illinois state courts. In the federal court system, she has brought the issue of whether her termination was based on discriminatory factors. She could have proceeded in that forum, in this forum, in the federal district court, without difficulty. The problem was, because she also attempted to proceed in the state courts, she created some res judicata issues. Now, what's interesting is the district court
said... But that's over with at this point. So if she just refrains from filing a state court appeal from the new merit board decision, would you concede that the district court is the place where that issue can be adjudicated?
In the context of a discrimination claim, yes. As long as she's indicating that the reasons for... I mean, basically, she'd be seeking the same relief, that is, reinstatement, back pay, etc., but she'd be putting it in the context of the reasons to terminate me were discriminatory. Without that discriminatory motivation, it doesn't belong in the federal
court.
What
else is she saying anyway? I mean, it's a Title VII 1983 case.
She's saying both in state court and in this court that the reasons that she was terminated were not bias-neutral reasons relating to her conduct. She's saying that they are reasons that relate to retaliatory animus.
Right. So she's not relying before the merit board on some obscure, you know, Cook County regulation that has nothing to do with discrimination. It's a discrimination case, wherever it is.
That's correct. The difficulty, first of all, the district court didn't consider the res judicata dispute at all. The district court looked beneath that dispute and said, I'm not going to even look at it on those grounds. I don't believe she's established a Section 1983 claim.
But the district court did say, not that it's terribly pertinent now, but did say some very strange things about the merit board, which is actually a part of the state's process it's not something for which we would give res judicata effect. That's pretty clear in the law. The circuit court's a different matter. The circuit court's a court, and then there's 28 U.S.C. Section 1738, but the administrative board, no.
Well, there's some case law that supports that some administrative proceedings do.
Some do, but there's particular case law about 1983 and Title VII cases to say that this kind of thing doesn't.
The res judicata issue, though, is not determinative of the ultimate outcome here. There is nothing before this court that would allow this court to conclude that this particular plaintiff put forth evidence sufficient to create a genuine issue of material fact on either of her claims for multiplicity of reasons. She has not defined what her protected activity was, either for the purposes of Title VII or for the purposes of Section 1983.
Can you tell me how many hours of hearings there were? Because it seems that the merit board hearing started on June 21st, 2002, ended on April 17th, 2003.
I didn't personally litigate their proceedings, so I can't estimate the hours. I am aware, simply because it happened in my office with other lawyers, that there were a number of continuances, that there would be an hour, 2 hours on a given date, and then the parties would agree to a continuance. So it was an unusual proceeding in that it dragged out over a long period of time, and I think a lot of it had to do with a significant number of witnesses being called in on one side or the other, whose availability was a bar to moving the case forward as you would like to see it move. But I believe that this plaintiff has not demonstrated that, by putting forth any admissible evidence, that there was any retaliatory animus against her on the part of any decision maker. She has not even identified what she contends was her protected activity or protected speech. We know that she made certain grievances during the course of her employment, but grievances don't constitute protected activity under Title VII, nor do they constitute protected speech under Section 1983.
Well, they could be. If the grievance was, I'm being discriminated against on the basis of my race.
Well, that's correct.
Title VII allows you to say that without being retaliated against.
Unfortunately, plaintiff
completely depends on what the grievance is.
Plaintiff puts forth that she grieved without those specific facts. If she had a grievance that went to a discriminatory act, yes, you're correct, but she simply talks about grievances of discipline without further detail. She doesn't give us any foundation for any of the conclusory assertions that she puts before the district court and also this court without factual support. And I think that's the fundamental flaw in plaintiff's claims.
She talks a lot about Smith against Sheehan.
She does. That particular case was a case in 1995-1997. She and a number of other individuals submitted affidavits to Plaintiff Smith's counsel discussing the conduct that they observed of the individual who was the defendant. I think he was named individually, but also the basis for any sheriff liability. Subsequently, this court in August of 1999 issued an order in that case. It's our position that her activity in 95 and 97, within a group of other officers who all wrote affidavits making observations about conduct, is too remote in time from anything that happens in the year 2000 or the year 2001 to constitute the basis for any retaliation action.
So you think it's impossible as a matter of law that once this court's opinion comes out and it's known that individual A was the snitch, basically, that couldn't be the kind of thing that would trigger at that moment retaliation?
I don't believe that those...
Even if the snitching happened 2 years earlier?
I don't believe that those are the facts here.
Well, if those were the facts, though, surely that could create a claim for retaliation.
Certainly it could if Yvonne Averhart were a snitch, but what happened in the Valeria Smith case is there was finding by this court that, and I know you're familiar with it, Your Honor, because
yes.
I know that you authored the opinion, but...
That
a single act, if it is severe and pervasive enough, can be the basis for a hostile work environment.
No, I understand that. I used the word snitch just to sort of be even, you know, more extreme, if you will. But the next layer down is to say somebody's testimony was the turning point in Ms. Smith's success, or, you know, was an important part of, or
that's simply not factually
record.
That's not factually correct.
But see,
if you
look at her timeline,
yes.
Her troubles came on the heels of the Smith decision, and then she alleges that they escalated after she filed her EEOC charge in September of 2000, and you know that, and then of course culminates with her termination following the second EEOC charge, which was in 2002. But that's a pretty close timeline, isn't it? Smith, as you note, came out in August of 99. Trouble starts. She
First of all, her initial discipline that she complains of was prior to August of 1999. There was a 5-day suspension, which she grieves, that precedes August of 1999. So clearly, Smith couldn't have motivated that. That 5-day suspension couldn't have been retaliated.
Well, but she'd already been involved in the Smith case. I mean,
as early as 1997 and 1995, in the form of an affidavit where she attests to certain observations made then that in the view of the defendant, even at that time, wasn't particularly significant in the overall picture of Smith. I mean, she stood with other officers giving information about conduct. But that's very remote in time. I think that what happens then is there is the commencement of a highly confidential internal investigation of narcotics trafficking within the jail that is ongoing over an extensive period of time prior to Smith. This ongoing investigation, she attempts to say that she filed an EEOC claim and then she was suspended. But we see the commencement of this internal, very involved, multi-individual investigation that involved not only her but several other individuals within the jail as targets, was ongoing for months. She learned about it in close proximity to the EEOC from inmates that compromised the investigation by revealing it to her. But the investigation actually preceded anything that could be construed as protected activity. Certainly, we concede that the EEOC claim is protected activity. But she recognizes that she's got time frame problems relying solely on the EEOC claim. So she talks about vague, unspecified grievances or complaints of corruption without giving us any foundation for those complaints.
Was this telephone switch arrangement unrebutted that belonged to her or was operated by her son rather than her?
I'm surprised to hear son. She was residing in the household with another woman, and there were young men, sometimes described as cousins, perhaps a son. I don't know which of the women's son it was, who alleged that some of those calls may have been directed to them. That ignores a few facts relevant to her own conduct, first of all. There was two conversations with an inmate that were recorded. In other words, because this was a criminal investigation of narcotics trafficking, there were predicate phone calls made with a view towards a COH. There were actually tape-recorded conversations between her and inmate Lang. By her own admission, she had communication with numerous inmates, not only in the Cook County Department of Corrections, but also in the Illinois Department of Corrections, where we're now dealing with convicted felons as opposed to detainees, who she personally characterized as lifelong friends and indicated that she continued to interact with during her employment with the Cook County Sheriff's Department, knowing that there were general orders that precluded that on the basis of it creating an appearance of impropriety. She also admits that she learned of the confidential investigation because inmates went to her and told her. Again, she concedes a relationship close enough with detainees and inmates that they reveal information to her about a confidential investigation where they may be serving as informants. So there was a significant amount of evidence that indicated that she maintained throughout her employment as a correctional officer relationships with detainees in contravention of the Cook County Department of Correction rules.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Anything else? Thank you very much.
The last few minutes, I guess, arguing the merit board record brings me to a point that I want to stress that shows us where we are. First of all, that I dispute all that. Everhart disputes all that in the merit board, and we're going to be making those arguments to Judge Donnersberger, who's going to review that record. We invited Judge Keyes to do so, and he declined, and that's fine. I suppose that's within his right. So, you know, to the extent that somebody's going to go into that merit board record, and that was our defense in the merit board, discrimination, retaliation. So to the extent a judicial officer is going to look at that and make that evaluation, we think that that evaluation should be all tied in with the summary judgment determination as well, because it's all the same evidence. We talked about Valerie Smith in the merit board and how this court's opinion came down and specifically mentioned Everhart in the opinion, and then 3 days later, the internal affairs investigation that resulted in the merit board determination and proceeding was open. Now, sure, they may argue that we didn't go to the Illinois Human Rights Commission, but of course we're going to argue we went to the EEOC. And the EEOC and the Illinois Human Rights Division cross-file. And, you know, obviously at the time, you know, we had elected to go into federal court with our federal discrimination claims, as is our right to do. So I think that would satisfy the circuit court's jurisdictional concerns. Certainly we can present those arguments to Judge Donnersberger in the first instance if there's a remand and a stay under the Colorado River Doctrine. Because if we do elect to proceed and appeal the Merit Board's decision, and we run some risk if we do, because then we get into that res judicata bar, because if Judge Donnersberger beats this court's opinion even, we're out of the box. So if we do elect to do that, we're going to try to get those claims all in the circuit court.
Now,
if we don't, we run a risk.
Would you be in that situation if we had had your response to the summary judgment up here?
Would I be if you had had my 56.1 statement? Mm-hmm. I think I would be in that situation, yes, either way. That's a non-unique situation because the Merit Board record is totally different now. It's been vacated. There's been a remand. There's been additional proceedings before the Merit Board. And, you know, again, I'm going to look into the 56.1 issue. You know, we're also considering making a Rule 60B motion in the district court because we sought to present new evidence, newly discovered evidence in the Merit Board. And so, you know, we're within the time frames to do that. And now that there's a new Merit Board decision, we may actually make a 60B motion and deal with the record issue that way. I guess the point is that I don't want to be in a race to judgment situation. I want to get all of Officer Everhart's claims in one court. From the undisputed record before this court, there is the argument that Kurtovich, Chief Kurtovich, said, I'm going to get that bitch. And that was testimony that was overheard by Officer Dotson. And that Officer Dotson's testimony was presented to the Merit Board, or made part of the Merit Board proceedings, and portions of those were presented to Judge Keyes. But it's undisputed in the record that that comment was made. And we believe that that comment alone is sufficient direct evidence of retaliatory animus to defeat summary judgment. And all they argue in their briefs is, well, she didn't hear it clearly, and, you know, it wasn't really in context. And, of course, that's all for the fact finder as well. I mean, if Dotson's testimony is credited, I'm going to get that bitch, we defeat summary judgment. And that alone is a basis to reverse the district court's opinion. Although the district court does say in its opinion that he is deferring and that she had a full and fair hearing before the Merit Board. Again, as the linchpin, and because of the unique situation we're in with these two different forums and we're, you know, the procedural posture we're in, we think it would be appropriate. And in fact, I think that this court could even order the stay, that this court could vacate the district court's opinion and direct that the district court stay proceedings under Colorado River, and then we can go and argue in front of Judge Donnersberger about the whole question about the Human Rights Commission and whether we're even allowed to bring our federal claims there, and then once those decisions, because those are important decisions of state law, because it's the state that needs to be deciding how its administrative review actions interface with federal actions, especially in view of this court's opinion in Durgin's. And it's important for all governmental employees to get some guidance on that issue. Judge Donnersberger was not aware of this court's opinion in Durgin's, and I brought it to his attention, and he said it raises some very interesting questions of state law. And it does, because there is some state law that says that there is no jurisdiction to hear Section 1983 claims in the circuit court, but this court's opinion in Durgin's says if you don't assert them there, you're barred. And that's a question where there's been no state law ruling, an ideal Colorado River question. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. We move